Okay, so today on the Loopcast, I have Philip Smith, and we are talking about Syria. So, Philip, to begin with, give us an update on the state of the conflict. Sort of, the last time we talked about Syria on the Loopcast was about 2 months ago, and the situation strikes me as so fluid that everything has changed. And maybe like our knowledge from 2 months ago isn't really, everything has, altered because of sort of the conflict. So update us on, where is the position of the government? Where is the position of the rebellion or the revolution?
Okay. Well, first off, Bashar Assad's forces are they're su I mean they are suffering a lot under the hands of a number of rebel offensives, but this conflict has actually devolved into a much conflict. It's not running all over the place. There's no real coordination between rebel offensives. We're seeing a very, very large offensive near Daraa and also in the outskirts, the suburbs of Damascus. However, this isn't really being operated in concert with any northerly operation by other rebel forces. It's pointing to me that what this generally says is the rebels are incredibly disparate. They may be under a number of larger umbrellas, for instance, the Syrian Islamic Front, which has Ahrar al-Sham, as a major force within it, or the FSA, which has a number of large militias that are within it. However, no one's really operating geographic zone. So if you have a force in Daraa, they're going to be launching an offensive in Daraa, and that's about it. So that's been kind of the general theme of what's going on. Now, Bashar al-Assad, we've seen reports for what, 2 years now, saying, oh, well, he's going to collapse, he's going to fall any day. His military is doing very poorly, they're very poorly equipped, they don't really know what they're doing. I find all of those reports to be incredibly premature. This is a life or death battle for him. He cannot lose Damascus, and we can see from how hard he's fighting it out there, and also how hard he's fighting to keep lines of communication open between there and Latakia, which is in the north, coastal Syria. He's not giving up. I mean, he launched a minor counteroffensive in the north, in Idlib province, quite recently, about a week ago, and it's been going on from there. The bigger problem is with rebels when they are also attacking, and they launch counterattacks as well. They have a very hard time holding on to the territory. And in addition to that, they have a very hard time administering and also taking care of the people who are living in that area, many of which are refugees. And also you have local residents. So in general, it's a very, very uncomfortable position who are on the ground. Aleppo is insane. Aleppo is a prime example of this. The city is split, not really down the middle, but you have the rebels controlling large chunks, and you have the government controlling large chunks, and each side has been duking it out in a very, very static form, as I said. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Green Line in Beirut around 1986. Yeah, I mean, this is just there's the split. You have your forces looking at each other at times. Occasionally, they'll open fire. There's sniper fire. There are certain no-go areas, and meanwhile, the people who are living on every on both sides, they're just trying to. That's kind of how it looks. It's a very, very dire situation.
So, would you consider this conflict mostly urban or mostly rural? I mean, in your explanation, you mentioned a lot of cities. So, is the focus of this conflict now mostly urban, or is it really something that's, taking place out in the field, outside the cities, or is it, is this like a is this really an urban-based insurgency, so to speak?
No, if we're comparing this to earlier so-called urban insurgencies in South America or other campaigns that have taken place in cities to deposed governments that are there, it doesn't really match up. I mean, there's urban conflict, and there's also rural conflict. However, the rebels, and we can say this, you know, their equipment is not of the same. They don't have the same amounts of equipment or arms or ammunition as the regime. They fight in a much more asymmetric pattern. So, I mean, if you take a group like Jabhat al-Nusra kind of works in these concentric circles around urban areas. They were attacking rural checkpoints, supply depots, airfields, which were a little bit more disconnected from urban areas. They were going after those first, and then they were moving into the cities. Then you have other groups, which were more localized militias, and they were just fighting in the cities. You have a few different FSA battalions in Damascus, just in Damascus, that dominate certain small neighborhoods, not even the entire neighborhood. So it's really the pattern of the conflict is really all over the place. Heaviest fighting, one day it can be in a more rural area, although I don't believe that the regime really enjoys fighting in those areas. In fact, I don't think the regime enjoys anything in terms of conflict where they can't utilize their with artillery, aerial bombardment. I mean, they have a lot of ranged weapons that the rebels do not have access to and also don't have any real experience with. So it's really turned into, I don't want to say a free-for-all, that makes it sound a little too crazy, but each side kind of has its own favored way of fighting. And because we have a rebel force, which is just so, I mean, they're separate in many ways. They've adopted different techniques through the different areas. They are not really adopting a comprehensive technique to fight the regime. As simple as that.
So in this you know, mixed up sort of conflict, where do we place, where do we factor in sort of Islamists and jihadis on the Sunni side of things, and then sort of Hezbollah, Iran, and other Shiite groups? Sort of where do they come into play, you know, in terms of, you know, Assad versus the rebellion?
Well, Shia groups are almost entirely on the side of Bashar al-Assad. I have not seen a Shia battalion with the FSA, and I doubt that we are going to see that, because where are they going to get funding from? Iran and also the Syrian government helps fund them. So they are, you know, hands down with Bashar al-Assad and his regime. On the other side, if we're talking about Sunni Islamist groups, and this includes Jabhat al-Nusra, and this includes other more Salafi-oriented organizations, generally speaking, they're, you know, when they're with the rebels, quote-unquote, they're not always, let's say, sometimes they're just independent groups. Other times they're involved with the Syrian Islamic Front. Aaron Zalin did some really wonderful work focusing on Syrian Islamic Front and how they've put together a little network of militias, or they're with Jabhat al-Nusra. Now, I mean, the split between the two couldn't be greater. I guess kind of going off of that, in terms of Islamist groups, it's very, very hard to reach down and just say these groups fit X paradigm, because they don't. We've seen a lot of secular fighters say, I want to join Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an Al-Qaeda subsidiary, because they fight well, because they are taking on the regime regularly. They have money, they have newer weapons, they have much better tactics than other rebel groups, and also they're viewed as much cleaner. You know, they're not stealing out of the grain supplies in local towns. They're administering things a little bit better than, let's say, your average FSA group. So you'll see a lot of fighters who were not Islamists, who are not carting around a Quran, and they're not saying, well, you know, we need jihad across the Middle East, say, join Jabhat al-Nusra. Now, this is part of Jabhat al-Nusra's strategy, of course. You know, they want people to come on board to them and say, we like their system best, and they run the show the best. But it also shows just kind of how fluid and changing the situation, you know, how quickly the situation changes on the ground in Syria. people want to back, as Lee Smith said, they want to back the strongest horse, and that's what they're doing. It's the conflict's gotten very bloody and very drawn out, and so they're going to say if Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham, if they're fighting the hardest, if they're doing the best job, and we like them, we're going to go with them.
So let me sort of press you on this point. When you say Shia groups, are we saying sort of Twelver, sort of, you know, the Shia groups of, you know, Shiite, you know, Shiism as it's practiced in Iran? Are we sort of, you know, sort of saying, you know, Alawi, or are we saying they're more Seveners? I mean, sort of guide us through, because I think for the, you know, our audience and sort of how we think about Shiism and sort of national security, it's always, we always associate it with Twelvers as opposed to sort of, you know, really getting into the complexity of it. So the Shiite groups, are we talking about sort of Alawi, or are we talking about Twelvers, or is it really a mix? Like, is it, you know, an indistinguishable mix of, you know, groups?
Well, you know, it's very easy. Unfortunately, the narrative in the media kind of says, well, Alawi, they fall under Shia, and they fall under this, and they fall under that. I'll try to give a little bit more detail, where Twelver Shia in Syria are not a very large population. They're not, but they're located in a number of very strategic areas. Now, we also have the Ismailis. Now, the Ismailis are a very, very old group in Syria, and they control, or they actually used to dominate what were the Alawi highlands, that, you know, the coastal highlands where the Alawi now dominate. And interestingly enough, the Ismailis are not really on the side of the Alawis all the time. There have been a number of smaller conflicts between the two groups. In fact, a number of Ismailis wanted to even join with the rebellion, albeit they were a little bit more peaceful. They were not taking up arms. Al-Nusra, and this is what Jabhat al-Nusra said, that they had attacked them. After one of their towns was attacked a few months ago, the kind of protests for them died down, and they were not as vocal against Alawi domination as before. So we have that factor. Then you have the Alawi. And the Alawi are the most interesting ones here. They keep being, and I keep seeing that they're lumped in with the Shia. They embody, they've adopted a number of Shia concepts. But these are wrapped into other spiritual beliefs that they have. They're their own sect. And when they were first considered as Muslims as part of Shiism, Musa Sadr, who was a leading cleric in Lebanon at the time, he was the one who was politically expedient at the time to say that the then dictator of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, was a Muslim. And he understood that it would help his community in Lebanon. And eventually we had groups, we had the Iranians who said, yeah, this is great. We agree. They're on our side on this one. So it's a very, very dynamic and quite a diverse group of people.
Okay. So before we get into more detail about Iran's role in this sort of this conflict, I'm interested. You tweet a lot, you and at Brown Moses sort of tweet a lot about the arms and the munitions in play in this conflict. So I'm curious, you know, what types of arms and munitions are being used on both sides of the war, and sort of who is supplying who. So particularly I'm interested is, you know, do outside players have a preference who's being armed, and, you know, and how does that play into the conflict? Like, does Iran explicitly arm Shiite groups and Alawi groups? Does, you know, the Gulf Arab states, do they arm, you know, Sunni groups, you know, and then, you know, what arms and what munitions are being used?
Okay. Well, very clearly, Iran is arming the Syrian regime, but they're also supplying foreign fighters, small arms, ammunition, to their other smaller Shia groups that they are establishing right now. They're also shipping a lot of many munitions to Lebanese Hezbollah. They've been doing this for a while. They're not newcomers to this game, and this is not their first rodeo. So they kind of get how it works. They were running these deemed milk runs into Damascus Airport, where they were loaded with fighters and loaded with weapons. and just dumping them off for Bashar al-Assad to distribute out to popular committees. These are not always sectarian militias. Sometimes they are Sunnis that are loyal to the regime, and they will take up arms and fight with them. There are a number of Palestinian popular committees that are associated with the PFLP-GC in Yarmouk, although they've been pretty thoroughly dealt with by FSA and also Islamist rebel battalions. So, I mean, it's, you know, the Iranians are supporting who will really keep Bashar al-Assad in power. And Bashar al-Assad has kind of already assessed the situation to say, okay, well, I'm going to support groups are in these strategic locations. For instance, what they did was in Aleppo, there was a Christian neighborhood up there, and they started supplying AK-47s, ammunition, magazines. These are small arms you can kind of acquire just about anywhere. The rebels have been, you know, just for a while now. An AK-47, you know, AK-47s, and the ammunition is much more accessible. Now, you do have the other component to this whole mix, which are, you have Saudi Arabia and you have Qatar. You know, Qatar is kind of the mouse that roared in this scenario, as they did in Libya. They were supplying a lot of different small arms. Now, there is this, you know, what came onto the playing field was the FNFAL. I have written about this before. This FNFAL magically appeared in Syria, and this weapon was one of the most widely distributed small arms in the world. However, Syria, you know, being a patron of the Soviet bloc for many, many years, didn't really have this weapon at all. So magically, all of these rebel groups are somehow acquiring these FNFALs. Now, I would assume that Qatar had been supplying them and also supplying them with a lot of the ammunition, because they fire the 7.62 by 51 NATO standard, than the NATO standard right now, which is M16s, M4s, those patterns of weapons. So you'll see that. Then you'll also see the rebels have access to illegally bought weapons. And these are usually bought from Lebanese dealers. Some of the Lebanese dealers are Shia. Some of the Lebanese dealers are Sunni. Some of them are Christian. They're in a trade, and they're going to sell their wares.
Right.
You found an example of Syrian rebels carting around an Israeli weapon. This was the Israeli version of the FNFAL that they must have bought from some arms dealer in Tripoli and were using in the conflict against Bashar al-Assad's troops. Now, oddly enough, this same weapon may have been used against Hafez al-Assad's troops by the Christian Lebanese forces a number of decades ago. You know, this is kind of the Middle East. It's very, very fluid when it comes to weapons being supplied. Now, that doesn't really address heavier weapons. We've heard the recent reports, you know, Elliot Higgins, who is Brown Moses, who I talk to every now and again, he really got it down. The Croatians were supplying a number of arms to certain rebel factions. Now, there are reports out there saying the CIA had vetted certain groups, and they were making sure that whatever weapons were given to them really fall in the wrong hands. Essentially, it was to bolster more moderate groups. Now, these are not, and I hate this phrase, but it fits. They're not game-changing weapons. They're not. These are not the most modern generation tools. Many of them are rocket-propelled grenades, patterned anti-tank. It doesn't even function. Tank rock.
So
it's been outclassed. But
I'm curious then. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, I don't want to interrupt you.
No, I'm curious then because, looking at sort of, Iraq, Afghanistan, and sort of, those conflicts, it seemed, the IED was a big weapon, especially in Iraq. So I'm curious then, do we see the IED being used in Syria? Because, looking at your feed, looking at Brown Moses, I do see, basically the weapons you just outlined for us, but no real mention of IEDs. So I'm curious then, have they played a role in this conflict, or is it, you know, something that really hasn't come up yet?
Absolutely. IEDs, actually, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, they've turned into a mainstay over the past year. Just jumping onto Jabhat al-Nusra with their car bombs, they were manufacturing car bombs that which were very, very similar to the ones which were used in Iraq by al-Qaeda, and also by, you know, by their Islamic State in Iraq, and a number of other tying up artillery shells and sticking them in the back of trucks and cars and driving them into certain security apparatuses and blowing them up. But we've also seen, and this is, it has not been as prolific as Iraq, but they've been using them, where certain IEDs will be placed in both urban and whenever a regime tanks or armored personnel carriers or the Shabiha, which are kind of this wide smattering of pro-Assad militiamen, whenever they cruise by in these Toyota pickup trucks, they will blow them up. But I mean, I would say that it has not been as Iraq. That's a given. But they're there, and they're using them quite a bit. But it's rare. I mean, you have to really. It's rare in the sense that you have body forums to really see some of the video and some of the camera work that shows these attacks. Mainstream rebel groups are not really using suicide car bombings. They're not pulling off IED attacks as much. I simply would say that they don't have as much experience in that realm. Whereas, of course, al-Qaeda groups, especially coming out of Iraq, they do have the experience. This is another reason why Jabhat al-Nusra is pulling a lot more people in. You know, they have a lot of guys with a lot of experience. So, you know, you have to juxtapose this to what the other rebel groups are doing to make up for those problems. And this also plays into the weaponry that we've been giving them. When I say, you know, the U.S. has given their nod to it, when we hand off older generations like recoilless guns or recoilless rifles or certain rocket-propelled grenade systems, this levels the playing field. This gives them an intermediate ranged weapon to attack armored convoys or armored equipment that Assad is using.
So my last question for the sort of arms and munitions, for the IEDs, is this explosives that are being sort of circulated in Syria? So sort of what I noticed in sort of Iraq is that in the beginning, you know, the IEDs were composed of, you know, artillery shells, mortar shells, basically stuff that had been found in Iraq and then sort of repurposed for, you know, the IED or the vehicle-based explosive. But I'm curious, and, you know, what is the trend in Syria? I mean, is most of these explosives coming from within Syria and within sort of the armed depots in Syria? Or, you know, are we seeing sort of more advanced explosives and knowledge coming, you know, from either al-Qaeda or Iran? Or is it mostly, you know, stuff that people have basically found in Syria and then, you know, repurposed for, you know, an IED?
It's really hard to track where a lot of the tools they're using are coming from. I would actually argue that a lot of it is coming out of Assad's stocks. What was stolen or taken or captured by certain rebels, you know, you have to remember the rebels are also trading amongst themselves the weapons they capture or they're given or they come across. So if a combatant from Jabhat al-Nusra comes over to another brigade that needs money, because a lot of them need cash, they're not getting outside funding, and says, hi, you have a number of 125 millimeter tank rounds. Can we buy a few of those? I'm quite sure that that's what happens. And Jabhat al-Nusra, I keep using them as an example because they're a prime example of this. They have cash behind them, so they can buy these things. So that, I mean, that would actually be, for me, the most rational explanation for where they're getting a lot of these heavier weapons to use in car bombs or in improvised explosive devices. That seems like the most likely tool, that, you know, or I should say tactic that they're using to assemble them.
Okay. So let's switch gears a little and sort of, you know, focus on, because I think this is a really understudied and misunderstood, you know, element. And that's sort of where do we place Iran and Hezbollah specifically into sort of the Assad regime's sort of survival strategy? Because I'm really curious because it seems like, you know, both Iran and Hezbollah are very much dependent on Assad as sort of the connection between the two entities. And at the same time, you know, not a lot has been reported about Iran and Hezbollah's, you know, entry into the fray, into, you know, specific, you know, conflict. So sort of, you know, detail for us. I mean, you've done a lot of great work on sort of, you know, on your Twitter feed and, you know, what I've read, you know, sort of explaining how Hezbollah's role and sort of Iran's role. So explain for us, you know, where does Iran and Hezbollah fit with the, you know, that survival strategy, the Assad regime's survival strategy?
Okay, well, first and foremost, Iran and Syria, just as Hezbollah and Syria, all of this is a symbiotic relationship between all of them. And when I say it's symbiotic, it means Iran requires Syria in their Near Eastern strategy. They are an Arab state. They are ruled by a very friendly regime. Well, they are currently ruled in many parts by a friendly regime. So that, I mean, that definitely plays into it. But Hezbollah is now we could argue the dominant actor in Lebanon. The only way for Iran to supply its subordinate, Hezbollah, with weapons, support, pull its guys back into Iran to do training, is through Syria. Syria is the strategic decision to work with them, and also the Syrians have made the strategic decision to play, you know, as a second fiddle or a junior partner to Iran's grand regional strategy. This doesn't mean that they are, you know, for the Wali al-Faqih in Tehran, you know, they're not swearing loyalty to Khamenei, but they are the linchpin for the Iranians. Now, Hezbollah, just to kind of get this out of the way, Hezbollah is completely loyal to Iran. There's kind of no argument over this. And I've heard a lot of arguments. They say, well, you know, they might be a little bit more independent. They're not. They're not. They swear loyalty to Tehran. They follow Tehran's strategy. And, I mean, their survival in many ways does depend on the survival of the Assad regime. Now, this doesn't mean that Iran has not plotted out and tried to strategize what would happen if Assad fell. They're not stupid. They operate a very, very successful and intelligent grand strategy. Tony Badran with Foundation for Defense of Democracies came up with the best explanation for it, in my opinion. And he actually said that they try to create essentially what they're doing in Syria right now. Among the Kurds in the north, certain Kurdish groups, they've been trying to do it with even certain Sunni groups that are in Lebanon, even though one would think the Sunnis in Lebanon would just despise them after everything Iran has pushed down on them via Hezbollah. But they try to get their fingers into just about every pie, and they will continue trying to build influence. So when it comes down to it, when it comes down to assembling Shia groups that are going to assist Syria, Iran has a wide range to choose from. It's another thing that's very important to remember that Iran, their intelligence apparatuses are not the best when it comes to Arabic language outreach, when it comes to people. So they use groups like Hezbollah and also their other Iraqi-based subsidiaries like Asaiba or Kataib Hezbollah. They've been using these guys as, I don't want to say mercenaries, but it's a very loaded term, but they're doing their bidding on the ground. So what they actually did in Syria, this is a very, very interesting, they have created the Fadl Abu Abbas brigades in Damascus. Now, one of their narratives is that, well, this group is protecting the Zainab shrine in Damascus, which is a major shrine for 12er Shia. the largest school of Shiism. That story, of course, has a lot of holes in it, because you have to remember the shrine is located in a strategic area in Damascus, and also these militias have been fighting the rebels for quite a while, not just around the shrine's environs, but around Damascus. They are an irregular unit that can go and take pressure off of Syria's armed forces and also off of their more elite divisions to handle problems elsewhere. So that's how they're functioning. Then you also have Hezbollah in this mix. And Hezbollah first denied that they were ever fighting in Syria. They've kind of gone through this whole course of narrative over the past couple months where initially they said, oh, well, we had fighters who died doing their jihadist duty. Everybody knew that meant they died in Syria. But they would never come out and admit it. Now they're coming out and saying, oh, no, no, our guys are dying, fighting, protecting the Shia villages in Qusair, and they're also fighting, dying, protecting the shrines or the Zainab shrine in Damascus. Again, more lines, but what they're doing is they're pulling pressure off of Assad from the rebels. They're also protecting strategic points that, you know, points of communication linking, you know, certain areas that are linking the two. In Qusair, which kind of came onto the scene in January, February, a few people who kind of write very positive things about Hezbollah were coming out and saying, well, Hezbollah is just defending these Shia villages. That's all they're really doing. What they neglected to say were these villages, which are inhabited by Lebanese, the majority of them are Lebanese Shia, because these are more kind of rural and transitory people, they can overlook the Alawi Highlands. There are certain, the geography there is so strategic that it controls the road that goes from Damascus in through Homs. This is an area that the regime needs to control. It's been cut two or three times in the past couple of months by the rebels, and they can't have that. You know, they need to maintain those lines of communication, and that's essentially what Hezbollah has been doing. So, grand scheme of things, they will make the argument that they are protecting Shia or even other religious minority existence in Syria, and of course that plays very well, but what they're really doing is they're playing a very, very strategic game. They're maintaining areas, and they're making sure the rebels don't cross any red lines.
So do you see this as a success then, in sort of the larger picture of supporting the Assad regime? Because it really seems that, you know, on one side of the argument, that, you know, Hezbollah and Iran have been successful in dragging out the war. But on the other side, you know, suddenly Iran and Hezbollah are becoming targets, you know. So sort of guide us through, is, you know, would you evaluate this as a success, you know, for, you know, whatever strategy they're aiming for? Or is this, well, you know, oh, go ahead.
It's hard to say success or failure. Look, Iran has all of its eggs in this basket, and they have to. They've tried to expand out. They tried to create those islands of influence. They're going to continue to try to do that, but Assad is the guy they need to back to make sure the system that they've been working for a while stays in place. And in terms of keeping certain road networks and certain strategic neighborhoods and areas open, yes, these groups have been very successful. I mean, they've pulled in Iraqi Shia jihadists. You know, these are all people who've sworn their loyalty to Khamenei and to the ideology that the Iranian regime promotes. But at the moment, they're not spreading that ideology. They're fighting. They're just kind of direct fighting against the rebels. Iran isn't really going to get out of this unscathed. They already understand this. They may be pushing for a pan-Islamic, you know, Sunni and Shia revolution, but Syrians at the moment are really not interested in that. So in the wider scheme, yeah, I mean, obviously this support of Assad will hurt them on the, you know, quote-unquote Arab street, but at the moment they don't care. You know, if they have the control, if they win the day, they won. Simple as that. Militarily, are they succeeding? Yes and no. That neighborhood where the Zainab Shrine is located, and they're doing quite a lines of communication open. They've kept the villages near Qusair relatively well protected from any advances that the Syrian rebels may have made. So you have that, but then again, there's also the other downside. Hezbollah needs it to be quiet in Lebanon. There have been a few who've speculated, well, they need a war with Israel right now. No, they don't. They couldn't keep themselves going, and it would really be destructive for Hezbollah's power base in the country if they just all of a sudden jumped and did that. So they have to also worry that now they have a threat coming in from the east, which are these enraged Sunni militiamen. And how are they going to handle this? So, you know, they need to make sure that this doesn't all of a sudden, again, another term I despise, the spillover term. They don't want it to spill over into Lebanon. They don't want this fighting to come in there, because the last thing they'd want are for already they're getting a little restive, the Sunnis in Lebanon, to start shooting at them too. They don't want fighting within Lebanon. They're happy to keep it in Syria at a certain level. And it's already, you know, they're already starting to get rocket attacks that, you know, from the rebels that are hitting their positions in the Baqa Valley and in the north near Akkad. So, you know, again, there are pluses and minuses. I just think, you know, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place. And there's not much they can really do except for militarily win the day. And they're going to continue to try to do that.
So before we get into sort of Hezbollah and sort of Lebanon, I'm curious, and has Hezbollah's, you know, being involved in the conflict in Syria, has that sharpened, you know, sectarian themes? I mean, it seems like, you know, Hezbollah is very much explicitly Shiite, and Jabhat al-Nusra is very explicitly Sunni. So I'm curious then, you know, those two organizations, have they sort of, you know, sharpened sectarian themes of the conflict, you know, taken what was already there and sort of made it worse? Or was it, you know, even before their being involved, you know, it was, you know, already sectarian to begin with?
There were feelings of it that were there on the ground to do about it. Have they exacerbated? Yes. But the feelings are there. You have the Alawi minority, you know, which is aligned with Iran, the prime Shia regime, at least, and one which pushes their Shia alike, and also won the day over in Iraq, you know, with their militia groups and certain little political positions they've been playing around with there. Of course, there's going to be a lot of Sunni anger. I mean, Sunnis comprise anywhere from 70 to 80% of Syria. So yes, of course they're going to vent their anger. And they were burning Hezbollah flags, because Hezbollah was very openly pro-Assad since the beginning of this. Of course they're going to be angry about it. Of course they're not going to like them. And they're going to have to reassess how they feel about the quote-unquote the Shia. But their involvement on the, in terms of exacerbated to the point where there's nothing one can do, it's immediately going to turn into some hyper sectarian warfare. No matter what you're going to do, I think you're going to find a piece of that, because there are certain groups that are interested in it becoming that. Jabhat al-Nusra, which has the Al-Qaeda in Iraq ideology, though they're using a different strategy on the ground. They're very open to doing that. Why? Because they want to say the Alawi are, you know, they're kuffar, they're infidels. They don't consider them Muslims. So of course they're going to turn this into, we are fighting, you know, these infidel Alawi and these infidel Shia, these rejection. And now Hezbollah is supporting them. And then you have Hezbollah that's going to say, and they've been saying this from the start, you have Jabhat al-Nusra. All the rebels are just like Al-Qaeda. What they want to do is crush any Shia, and this is a sectarian war. It's my opinion that at the end of the day, if we're just talking about Iran and Iranian strategy, Iran doesn't want intra-Islamic conflict unless it benefits Iran. Benefit Iran. So it makes their position very, very tough. Now, Jabhat al-Nusra and the Al-Qaeda elements, they could care less. They want to win the day, and their extreme Salafi ideology, they need to kick the hell out of those they consider infidels. This doesn't end in just massacring Christians or massacring Shia, but it definitely plays into it.
So for the last part of the conversation, I want to sort of switch to, you know, how has the conflict in Syria affected Hezbollah's position in Lebanon? Because it seems that the way I've understood Hezbollah's relationship to Iran is that, you know, the organization is very tight with Iran and very, you know, not, I shouldn't say tight, but it's really, you know, part and parcel of, you know, sort of Iranian foreign policy. But, you know, Hezbollah still sort of, you know, its power base in Lebanon is very much rooted in the Shia of, you know, the Dahiya and of the south and of the Bekaa Valley. So I'm curious, you know, how has Hezbollah's, you know, involvement in Syria affected that constituency? I mean, do you see sort of a push and pull? You know, is it a quiet sort of acceptance, or is, you know, are there sort of rumblings coming from particular Shia quarters in Lebanon?
There will always be rumblings from one sector or another. Look, Hezbollah runs the show for the Shia. They will use force against Shia who speak out too much. They've done it before. You do have independent Shia. I've actually written about the independent Shia, who are generally aligned with March 14th Alliance, meaning they're anti-Hezbollah. But they only have so much influence among other Shia in the country. Now, besides Hezbollah participating in the war, you also have Harakat Amal. Harakat Amal is the number two party for Shia in Lebanon.
Right.
And they in Syria too. But, you know, again, this was kept very, very quiet. They only ratcheted up their involvement in Syria when they had fully fulfilled the narrative that the people they were fighting were Al-Qaeda elements. That's how they've done it, and that's also how they've won legitimacy among Shia in the country. When I was mentioning before that they kept saying, we're fighting for Zainab's shrine, there's a reason behind that. That plays to Shia hearts. Well, this is a shrine of ours. This is kind of the thought that's behind it. This is a shrine of ours. These come in just like they did in Iraq when they blew up the, you know, our beautiful structures that were in holy cities. And we need to do everything to protect them. We don't want them coming here and doing that. This is, you know, this is the Shia heartland. We don't want to be absorbed in, because there are memories of Sunni oppression even before the Ottomans came in, you know, how Sunnis treated them. And Hezbollah is playing off of that to say, well, look, we haven't lost our legitimacy. We're actually defending your interests. We don't want you getting killed. There's another factor to this, and I mean, I don't want to go off of your question too much, but Hezbollah has been playing this to the Christians in Lebanon very, very well. They know who they're dealing with, and they understand that the Christians, above all, are afraid, especially after watching what happened in Egypt, and especially after watching what happened in Iraq, that they will look to other minority alliances. They've done this. Christian forces under the Lebanese forces aligned with the Israelis, using kind of the same thought process. Oh, these are minorities. They're afraid of the Sunni Shia coming in and absorbing them. And so we need to ally with them and defend our interests. And so Hezbollah is playing off of that too and saying, look what's happening to the Christians there. Your shrines are being attacked. You know, they're being mortared. We know what happened in Iraq. Align with us. We're minorities too. We get. And also, we have lots of guns. We have lots of money. We can be your face when it comes to fighting these evil Salafis. But again, this is all this is how they're playing it off to the quote unquote Christian street in Lebanon.
Let me ask you.
I'm sorry.
No. Let me ask you very explicitly then. You know, where do we place, you know, the Syrian Christians and the Lebanese Christians in this conflict? Because, you know, as you know, to build on your point, I remember in Iraq, you know, Iraq had a very vibrant Christian community. And then, you know, during that conflict, that community was sort of, you know, I'm not going to say eradicated because that's too strong of a verb, but definitely attacked and marginalized. So I'm curious, you know, where do we place the Christian community in Syria, you know, the Syrian Christian community and the Lebanese Christian community in this conflict? Because it seems like, you know, they're definitely, it's a minority, but it's definitely, you know, they can be targeted. There's a potential there, and it's definitely under discussed. So where do we place it?
Well, Lebanese Christians, this is a very, very hard thing to say. Lebanese Christians, since the Cedar Revolution in 2005, were split between Michelle Aoun. Michelle Aoun went over and became pro-Syrian, pro-Iran, and March 14th, which was primarily represented by a number of smaller secular parties, and all was a larger party, and the Kataib. So that's kind of their representation for more anti-Assad. This doesn't mean that most Lebanese Christians have a real love for Bashar al-Assad's regime, because just looking back into history, when Lebanese Christians were fighting the Syrians didn't kind of, you know, they gave them no the hell out of Ashrafi and out of many of the different Christian sections during the war. Many thousands of Christians were killed by the Assad regime, and even under Bashar al-Assad's rule, many Christian politicians were murdered, and the Christians generally felt their power, the little power they have in the region, because Lebanon is really the only place where they have any, was marginalized. They were kind of shunted off into a corner. Any support we're really seeing from the Christian sections for Assad, and I'm talking on a very, very wide base here, it comes with interest. It's hard for a lot of Americans to understand that the region is multipolar. Your enemy yesterday can be your friend today, and can be your enemy tomorrow, and you can be trading for gasoline all the time. And they are doing their best, in their opinion. I mean, if I were writing strategy for them, I would do many things differently, but I'm not. Going to hedge their bets with who they believe will most likely defend their interests. Because there's a balance of power in Lebanon. If they feel it's being tilted one way, they'll get worried. Now, this doesn't mean all Christians are all of a sudden saying, we love Bashar al-Assad, we need to support him against the rebels. There are many main Christian politicians. You have Samir Jaja, the head of the Lebanese forces, who came out and was very supportive of the rebels. This doesn't mean, however, that he's supportive of Jabhat al-Nusra or any of the Salafis, but his position is well understood. He's anti-Assad. He's anti-Assad, and you know, is going to push for that. But there, kind of the feeling in everybody, again, on a very, very normal level, even people who are hyper anti-Assad, who are Christian nationalists to the core, who want, they even want their own independent state, they will tell you, when it comes down to it, we hope that Assad doesn't lose. We don't mind that they're beating the hell out of one another. In fact, we hope they continue to do that so long as it doesn't hurt us here. But if anything, we'd prefer Assad to say a new Salafi regime or an anarchy that occurs there, which pushes more refugees into Lebanon, which pushes more Christians here. They can't really handle it. They don't know how to handle it. So, you know, it's selecting the lesser of two evils. They've seen what Al-Qaeda and subsidiaries and allies of Al-Qaeda have done to other Christian groups, and they don't want the same to happen to them. They understand what that means for Christian existence in the region. They look at Egypt and they say, we don't want that either. We don't want to be a marginalized, tiny minority that's fighting for our life every day. That's perceiving.
Well, I think this has been a great informative conversation. So usually I like to give the last remarks to the guest. So, I mean, is there anything before we end the conversation, you know, what, any last remarks or any last comments?
Last comments? Well, I can say, going back to Shia groups, one thing anyone who's watching the situation, this is something that's ignored many, many times or misunderstood many, many times by people commenting on it. If you're watching these Shia groups in Syria and Iraq and they're aiding Assad, normally they ascribe to Iranian ideological precepts. And, you know, if you see that they are pro Wilayat al-Faqih or Wilayat al-Faqih, as it's called in Persian, they are completely loyal to Iran. That's who we're seeing fighting over there. So if you read a report that says, well, you know, they're just doing this because they want to help a shrine, and by the way, they're pro-Iran because they believe in this, they're following Iran's orders. So never forget that. It's just something that keeps coming up. People are living under this impression that Shia, they drive to Damascus because they want to show. It's not just that. There are very, very deep-seated religious and ideological concepts that are at play here and driving them to fight with Assad.
Well, thank you so much. So that was Philip Smith. He can be found at Philip Smith on Twitter. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Appreciated it.
Oh, no problem.